Land full of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar with the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you.
And 8 months ago, of course, a lot of people were sort of bemused by the failure of a North Korean launch, which many commentators suggested embarrassed the new young leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. However, whatever embarrassment he had last time, this time around, it appears to have been a successful launch. I believe the North Koreans are dancing in the streets.
Yes, they are very happy and excited about it. It seems like I am disappointed that Eunha 3, which is the same vehicle as really Daepudong Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, ICBM, was successful. I was hoping that it would fail again, but it didn't.
But it's an old Soviet four-stage design, is it not? We're talking about 50-year-old technology here.
Yes, that is true. But because North Korea was North Korea's spectacular failures in the past, that this is considered a success.
But the fear is that they'll be able to deliver a nuclear warhead, that this has nothing to do with satellites, etc. This is a missile test, and then the next stage would be if they could put a nuclear warhead on it, then there'd be some real justification to be concerned. That, of course, leads you to ask where their nuclear program's at and what those two tests achieved. So what's yours?
Right. Yeah, well, the real issue actually is also proliferation. It's not that we feel that their program is so advanced. It's that North Korea is known to be a serial proliferator, and we are worried about them succeeding with missile technology and being able to transfer to foreign actors, other countries. That's the real issue, I believe.
But isn't that a two-way street? My understanding is that the Pakistan's Aku Khan network are the ones that shipped a lot of technology to North Korea. So give us a sense of the proliferation network. It seems to be a two-way street.
Yes, it is a two-way street. It is true that, particularly in terms of North Korea's uranium enrichment program, there's a whole debate on where it got initial technology. But yes, you're right. It is from Aku Khan network. But in the past, I mean, you remember with Syria nuclear reactor, North Korea assisted to Syria, there is some concern about North Korea and Iran connection. And until very recently, also North Korea and Myanmar connection as well. We cannot verify, but there was some talk, I don't know if you saw the South Korean press reports, about Iranian technicians sort of being in North Korea at the time, trying to help with their missile technology, because there was some sort of a technical failure, I believe.
So if you can't do anything about this, and one of the problems with North Korea is that they operate like the delinquent child. They misbehave with the expectation that they will be rewarded for their bad behavior. That seems to be the modus operandi. So given the limitations that the U.S. have, and China, of course, has much more influence but doesn't necessarily use that influence, is there any way to go after the brains, or is this all indigenous? In other words, do they have foreign, either ex-Soviet missile and nuclear specialists working for them? What's the situation in that regard?
Well, in terms of going after the North Koreans, and let me just comment on your initial comment of that, yes, this is a time-worn strategy of acting provocatively with a missile test and a nuclear test and so on, and then in trying to sort of reap benefits afterwards. In terms of what we can do, you're absolutely right. Not much. I mean, right now, I'm sure the, UN Security Council is meeting in Washington. I assume that Washington, Seoul, and Tokyo were pressed for some sort of, an action. But what we're really looking at is just another UN Security Council presidential statement. I'm not even sure if they can get a resolution out of it. And, they will be seeking to do additional sanctions on North Korea, on additional banks, businesses, and government entities that are violating sanctions. It's just a presidential statement. And the real question, as you say, is what would China do, since China has always been the biggest impediment to any kind of meaningful action against North Korea? We'll see what China will do. But in terms of China's North Korea policy, will there be any change or not under the new leadership, Xi Jinping? My guess is that it will be, from same old, same old. In terms of what I think they should do, it's a different question, but probably I think sanctions in something like what we did in 2005, which was very effective, was this when we went after North Korean accounts in Macau based Banco Delta Asia. That was quite effective, but we'll continue to go after Pyongyang's illegal activities such as currency counterfeiting, drug smuggling, and money laundering. And, perhaps we could strengthen South Korea's missile defense system, or we could try to work with Koreans and the Japanese in some sort of trilateral missile defense cooperation and so on. But outside of that, with those that I just mentioned, I see Washington's options being quite limited.
Again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So focusing in on the role of China with this new leader, Xi Jinping, who I don't think is in a very strong position. There was obviously some succession problems, and the previous leader seems to want to control the defense portfolio. So it's not entirely clear, even if he wanted to do something, whether he will. And then, of course, the Chinese foreign ministry put out a fairly bland statement saying China has always insisted on bringing peace and stability to the Korean Peninsula through multilateral dialogue. We hope relevant parties stay calm in order to maintain peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. But, you hear those kind of bland statements. But on the other hand, the impression I get is that the Chinese don't mind having this kind of mischievous partner in North Korea that drives the West crazy. It's a little game that they can play, isn't it?
Well, it's not that they don't mind. I do think increasingly they do mind, and they've been aggravated with North Korea, and even with Kim Jong-il, there was no love lost with Kim Jong-il. But you're right. The problem is China's and Washington's interests and priorities are just fundamentally not aligned. It's a cliche, but we say it for a reason. While we are really Washington, that is, focused on denuclearization, China is still very much focused on stability on the border and stability in the region. So because our priorities are different, they're just unwilling to really come down on North Korea because they are very risk averse about potential instability in North Korea. So it's really hard to get China to do anything. I think our only way, and we've been trying, is to continue to talk to the Chinese and trying to change their mindset and sort of to view this as their problem. But unless they really see it as a see eye to eye with Washington, they're not going to do much about it.
Well, so if I'm wrong, which I appear to be in suggesting that the Chinese don't mind having this mischievous neighbor that drives the West crazy, then what explains their inability? You're saying that they're aggravated by the North Koreans. They do an awful lot of trade with South Korea. It would make a lot of sense if there were direct rail and road links from South Korea to China because of the trade. I understand that there is a big refugee problem on the Chinese side of the North Korean border from people who are defecting and hiding out there. So it's not as if the Chinese don't know that there's a failed state on their border. I guess is what you're saying, Sumi Terry, is that they just don't want to upset this tenuous situation. Otherwise, a collapse would mean what to the Chinese?
Exactly. They prefer status quo because instability will bring potential collapse of the regime. And what that would mean is flood of refugees going to China. I mean, you have to remember in mid-1990s, during the famine years, there were many North Korean refugees that escaped to China. And that's what they fear. And in a potential collapse scenario and potentially unified Korea scenario, which would mean South Korean-led unification, they would not have this buffer zone anymore by the North Koreans. What would then have is unified Korea that's very U.S.-friendly and potentially with U.S. troops still on the Korean Peninsula. And remember the last time during the Korean War, Chinese absolutely just didn't want that. That's why we had the Korean War with China's intervention. So what they prefer is a status quo, even though they're not quite happy with how North Koreans are acting. This is a preferable scenario for them.
So why can't the U.S. give the Chinese guarantees that they wouldn't put troops on the Yellow River, that if the North collapses, that they would work for a smooth transition and give aid which would be needed and help China out with the refugee problems? I mean, that seems to be a win-win.
But they will still be facing unified Korea that's U.S.-friendly. Versus a, you know, China-friendly North Korea on the border. But as you are suggesting, American government officials have been trying to do that, even during Track 2 meetings and so on. What we've been trying to emphasize is at least transparency, and so that there's no miscommunication or misunderstanding, that should there be a collapse, maybe we can work something out. You know, we don't mean to intervene. We don't need to have U.S. troops going to go up the north of the DMZ and so on. And even if it's not a two-way street in terms of a dialogue, it's very difficult to talk to the Chinese about this issue because they don't even want to talk about potential collapse of their ally. What we are trying to emphasize, at least for sort of transparency's sake, that hey, don't misunderstand us. This is what our intention is, and we don't intend to, you know, occupy North Korea and so on. So we are trying to do that, but it's a very, very difficult issue. It's just been an ongoing issue for the last two decades, and everyone recognizes that China holds a card, a very important card, so we've been trying to talk to the Chinese.
Well, then what are the chances of a collapse? Because my understanding is that in many ways we have got the whole situation wrong in the West, that we look upon the North Koreans as the hermit kingdom, this Stalinist communist regime. And in many ways it's not a left-wing or ultra-left-wing regime. It's a ultra-right-wing regime, more in common with the fascist Japanese regime under Emperor Hirohito in the 1930s, with the worship of the emperor. That explains why this one family are worshipped so much. So at least that's my understanding, that that's the fundamental, that we don't even recognize the true nature of this regime. And the second question would be, I understand that it is being slowly undermined from within through smuggling from in and out of China. People get DVDs and CDs and music and television from the South. They recognize that their neighbors to the South, their brethren to the South, have an incredibly high standard of living, etc. So what's the trajectories? On the one hand, you've got this emperor worship business with the family, the Kim family, the paradox of a communist dynasty. But on the other hand, they're out of step with history and they're slowly being undermined from within.
Right. Now, first of all, in terms of the the potential stability, instability of the regime, and when would it collapse? Obviously, no one knows that. But I will tell you, and a lot, you know, some folks suggested that because of this whole emperor-like dynastic, you know, what you just described, that Kim Jong-un has firmly consolidated power, and the regime is stable. I wouldn't go as far as just to say that. You have to remember, he's still only year one of Kim Jong-un in power, just 28, 29-year-old. You also have to remember that Kim Jong-un lacks the revolutionary credentials that his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, earned as a guerrilla fighter against the Japanese. And unlike his father, Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un does not have more than a decade of training and preparations for the job which Kim Jong-il had. And without serving a day of military service, he was made four-star general. So he has a lot to prove, and this is why he did this missile launch also. He had, particularly after the spectacular failure in April, he has a lot to prove, and he still is in the process of consolidating. If you look at several purges that's been going on in North Korea right now, there's this one picture of, you know, the poor bearers. The guys were holding Kim Jong-il's casket in the funeral. The whole left side of those generals are now gone. So there's a lot of changes going on. And so I don't think anyone knows for sure exactly what's going on in North Korea. So it's not, you know, I wouldn't say that he has firm hold on power. We just have to see. And as you mentioned, in terms of the information penetration, information coming through the Sino-North Korea border, this is serious issue for North Korea. One of the pillars of stability in North Korea has always been through this information control, a monopoly on information, as well as ideological indoctrination and obviously the security apparatus and foreign assistance from China. But information, monopoly on information, was a very important pillar of stability, and that it has been eroding for some time. You've talked to all these North Korean defectors. All these guys have seen smuggled South Korean videos, soap operas, and so on. I've spent a lot of time with North Korean defectors, and I'll tell you that, you know, these guys are more on top of the latest South Korean, you know, soap opera and movies and movie stars than, you know, I am. So this is a real issue, and you know, some people also question, is Kim Jong-un a reformer or not? Would he reform like Deng Xiaoping, China? And the problem is, true reform would mean opening, and opening would mean more information coming through, and this is really a weakness for the regime right now.
Well, Sumi Terry, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asian Institute at Columbia University. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a general who wants to cut the Pentagon's budget.
Someone